Over measureless periods of time, the mineral, animal and vegetable kingdoms responded to the divine touch, expressing something of their own beauty even through the distortion engendered by contact with the dark environment in which eager but fallen souls were waiting their chance to seek easement through incarnation into this new world. When we consider our dual descent from these widely differing races of beings, the darkened souls of the indigenous inhabitants and the splendid beauty of the Adamic race, we can recognize the origin of the dual characteristics in ourselves, our basic lower self, the natural man, and the higher self, the nobility that rarely shines out through adversity. There is constant struggle between the two. The one belongs to the earth and seeks union with it, the other belongs to spirit and ever strives for reunion with spirit. The one lives by instinct, the other through inspiration. Between the two poles man lives and learns and progresses, suffering endless tension, yet in the main tending always upward. As the earth's crust hardened, it became more objective, and at this point Zeros was able to take me once more to see a world in the making. Changes that must have been slow, and mutations that must have covered endless generations, were swift and kaleidoscopic to us through our numerous visits over great periods of evolution. And I was able to see how, through endless cycles of birth, life and death, the evil miasma inherent in the lower astral realms was being manifested into physical form and passed harmlessly into the soil, there to be transmuted. And it was borne in upon me that the compassionate love of the cosmic Christ was woven into every atom of this assembly, enshrining all in divine purpose. It became clear to me that such a sorry manifestation of living space could never have been the intention of perfect love, but was rendered necessary by the defection of spiritual man. Though there was much beauty and wonder in this newborn world, there was nothing to compare with the pristine beauty and ethereal charm of the Garden Beautiful. Yet because the living Christ invested it, I knew that in terms of eternity, if not in time, the days of its shame were numbered and its redemption certain. "All is ordained in love," observed Zeros as he summed up his description of this primal epoch. How could it be otherwise when a God of love, to whom nothing is unknown and who forgets nothing, is the reality behind it all? To postulate that this grand vista of divine redemption is the process of a blind evolution is only to epitomize the narrow viewpoint of the purely intellectual outlook, based upon material values. Your able scientists demand proof, but here the proof lies in another dimension. And when you consider how the very nature and density of matter has changed since those far-off days, how could any proof remain through the eons of change and crystallization of every constituent in your world? This rescue of a fallen race is a gargantuan one, beyond all knowledge. The whole earth is invested with the love of God, and as long as man recognizes it and strives to live in its light, so long does he achieve peace of mind and sure progress. But where he opposes it with his free will, love ceases to be a warmth and becomes a consuming fire which burns him and causes suffering, not merely to the individual but to humanity as a whole. But in the end nothing can stand against the all-powerful love of God. So stupendous a power that if it were not veiled it would burn up the planet upon the instant. Even when man gains some small knowledge of these immense cosmic forces and turns them to ignoble use, thus perverting their natural characteristics, love steps in, passing through the prism of the cosmic Christ, to overturn and rebuild. Small wonder that suffering ensues. Can you not see how God only seems to be careless of his creation? It is only your lack of understanding of what is being done. The plan is so much vaster than you can conceive, it is not tied to incidentals. Evil is eternally being righted, the world itself is being lifted in vibration, little by little, so that with each generation it is more than it was. Many times Zeros and I wandered through these uneasy swamps, and in spite of the embryonic nature of all that we saw, we could not help sensing the goodness that seemed to pervade it all. The breath of divine understanding and goodly purpose seemed to integrate and leaven the plastic soil in a way that could never be in our own day. In the splendor of a dawn, in the soft glow of a sunset, or in the ethereal beauty of the growing vegetation, even in the rumble of an earthquake or the crash of a storm, one could sense a presence, a radiant manifestation of life, hidden only by the facade of matter. It has all gone now, for the crust has hardened and the senses of man have become veiled beyond the vibrations at which such divinity could be perceived. The very atmosphere has condensed until its opacity distorts human vision to the realities that lie beyond it. Only in some unfrequented spot, some high mountain top or the seabed momentarily uncovered by the falling tide, can that elusive sensation of extreme purity be regained, when you know what it is to hold all creation in your arms, and to feel the arms of the Creator about you. Back in my study I questioned Zeros about the relationship of the human body to the anthropoid apes, upon the evidences of which so much reliance is placed by those who postulate a blind evolution. Zeros sat for a while in deep thought. "That takes us into rather deep water," he observed. "Your researchers hold that man consists of a body, brain and growing intelligence, derived purely from mutational evolution. And they admit that there are great gaps in their theses which they are unable to bridge. They look to find these in the future. But there is no missing link in the physical sense. They will never find it on that level. The fusion of human and animal flesh is against spiritual law. Such unions could only produce a perverted species which could not be ensouled. Never did man assume form of an animal nature through procreation. You will recollect that we left the erring beings who fell from grace, confined within the density of the lower astral plane which surrounds your earth, waiting for a chance to incarnate. You will understand that these beings still retained a memory of the great creative powers they had once possessed, terrible powers if used wrongly. For they had once wielded forces beside which your atomic fission is but a toy. So their very intelligence had to be veiled while they were incarnate. The manner of creation, wherever it is met, can be seen to be in the form of patterns. The galaxies, the stars, every manifestation of life on your planet, presents itself in patterns. The seeding of a tree, human generation through heredity, all is done by patterns. And these divine patterns have their real blueprints in a dimension beyond your ken. An ape is born, like all else, from its own pattern, which may change according to environment but always remains a pattern, and it was from this undimensional pattern that the original form of man was created, because it was the most suited to the purpose. When the form had reached a suitable stage, the darkened souls were permitted to incarnate in these bodies. They were not brute animal forms, but to your present understanding they were almost ethereal, quite unsubstantial, and it was only through eons of time that they followed the trend of the earth and became solid flesh. But of necessity they were of a very low degree of what you would recognize as intelligence. As these creatures progressed and became more and more fleshly, the inherent urges that filled their soul being began to manifest. Urges made all the more rending by the sex separation I have already described. Prompted by the tremendous desire force in them, some of the males sought union with the anthropoids, which only now, long after the humans, were reaching a state of physical evolution. And because there was an affinity between the two, in the pattern, monstrous creatures were born of the union. These could not be ensouled and soon died out. Thus there are evidences of ape men, the remains of which have been discovered and have led to false conclusions. Has it not struck you how few of these there are? The bodies of the primitive men and women were not yet of such a coarseness that their remains could endure so long, and so none have been found. It is of great importance that you should try and realize the truth of what I am trying to impart. For there is no concept so destructive to the idea of benign godhead than this terrible thought that a god of love has experimented with humanity, dragging man up through endless centuries of suffering, privation and frustration, amid a nature which is hostile and destructive. I fear that you may find it difficult to make all this sound convincing in your narrative. The difficulty arises because tradition looks for concrete beginnings to human evolution, whereas the beginning, if you can use such a word in relation to the infinite, rests upon spiritual factors. There was emergence of the spiritual into the physical, not only of man but of his whole environment, the descent of an infinite concept into a finite. At no point could you say that the spiritual ended and the material began. But at least you can say this, that in the cold, rational theories of evolution there can be no sort of meaning at all, while in the real story of the earth meaning shines out with the promise, nay the certainty, of a glorious fulfillment. It is for this reason that you have to live, at present, largely by faith. I promised Zeros that I would ponder the whole subject before committing myself to paper. I realized then, as I still do, that truth must be allowed to speak for itself. We cannot hope to defend it by theoretical argument. But I am convinced that there is something within us that will respond to truths which cannot be couched in words. Time and time again, during our visits through time and space, and also as a cardinal point in his discourses, Zeros reiterated the need to recall the universality of man, which he held to be the key to understanding. As long, he said, as you hold that man is an isolated individual, responsible only for his own integrity and capable of achieving the ultimate aim of his existence by his own efforts, so long must you flounder in a muddy sea of conjecture. But once you can instill into your consciousness that mankind is a homogeneous whole, then many problems are resolved. It is natural that man should cling unduly to his personality, that he should identify himself too much with his physical being, but neither of these is immortal. The personality can change in a single lifetime, through an operation or through some deep emotional experience. Your personality is not what it was when you were a child. The fruits of experience are found in the personality, but the goodness of those fruits, or otherwise, is absorbed by what you could better term the individuality, a much more permanent attribute of the spirit. The personality may not long survive the dissolution of the body, but the individuality of the spirit goes on and on. This idea of unity in diversity is the principle of creation, for after all, if God created all there is, every diverse manifestation of that creation can be traced back to the one source. A grain of sand is but a concourse of atoms, vibrant with the Creator's life, manifested for a purpose, the same life which is your life. But you must not think that thereby you will someday lose your identity and be swallowed up in the primal essence. There can be no ending of the essential you, for there are no such limitations in eternal life. But as you progress, you will learn so to surrender your free will to the will of God through the utter longing of your whole being to be part of Him, that any idea of separation would be anathema to you. That is the best I can do to present the infinite in finite terms. But it is very important to try and encompass the idea with your understanding. I should like to describe what we saw of these early men, though that too is difficult. In the still slightly ethereal environment in which they found themselves, they seemed solid enough, but they bore little resemblance to the more backward races we know today. They were enormous in stature and hirsute in appearance, and they wore a puzzled, vacant stare as if they found their surroundings difficult to comprehend. They lived mainly on fruits and roots, not yet having learned to hunt animals for food. They were as far separated from any idea of divine creation as an empty shell is from a living crustacean. Clearly, the greater part of their intelligence was in a state of torpor. They wandered about like lost souls. It was hard to believe that these poor creatures had once been glorious spiritual beings with incredible powers of creation. Such was the extent of their fall and such was the mercy of their Creator that they were given this comparatively easy way out of the pit into which they had fallen. Once more Zeros emphasized how in their fall from higher state, they had brought with them the terrible odor of perversion which had its baleful effect upon any environment in which they found themselves. But their lack of intelligence prevented them from manifesting it except unconsciously, through the natural functions of their crude bodies, with the cooperation of the elemental beings in the soil upon which they had their being, absorbing, transmuting, rectifying the chemical perversion which had been wrongly assembled. So, with infinite slowness, through endless generations during which these souls incarnated again and again, the upward climb began, as they were in some measure freed from the clinging miasma of their erstwhile sin. The urges engendered by the bifurcation of their souls strengthen the need to overcome their harsh environment, filling them with spiritual vitality as they became accustomed to their surroundings. The males fought and conquered nature biased against them, while the females brought forth young in labor and pain. Together they learned the rudiments of family responsibility through the proddings of instinct. And between the two sexes there flashed the first gleams of human passion, the same pristine love they had once known but dragged down to the level on which they were now forced to live. While all this was happening, Zeros explained, the Adamic race was already beginning its errand of mercy, descending into incarnate life, but not yet of it, manifesting in forms not visible to the fallen race. With their superior intelligence they were able to lift the thoughts of the fallen ones and inspire them with something above the purely material. These were not yet capable of faith, but they could respond to its opposite, superstition, the other side of the penny, as it were. So gradually they became aware of a power outside of themselves, a factor enhanced by the terrestrial upheavals which still shook the cooling crust of Earth. And so began the system of worship, which has never been entirely lost through the ages. Naturally its early form was crude and inspired by fear, taking the form of propitiation. In time it crystallized into organized religion. The visiting entities, which later on became actually visible to them, were given names and attributes, and thus was born the pantheon of gods which illumine the mists of mythology, whose antics, pictured by contemporary minds, have so often amused later generations. Presently a desire to capture and possess such contacts, which made a great appeal to the dim understanding of these people, led them to erect stone cairns and monoliths at the places where these visitors were accustomed to manifest. In this way, it was felt, the entity could be worshipped whether actually visible or not. These were gradually enlarged and decorated, and given shelter from the elements, and thus the idea of church or temple grew. And all this time the process of passing through the defilement which was the cause of their situation, went on, entering the soil and being dissipated there. Who is to say whether they might not have attained their goal without further aid, but evidently divine prescience knew that the process could be speeded by the introduction of a fresh and undefiled race of beings, providing a new test of their spiritual strength, far greater than their struggles against natural forces, and without which they might have lost hope and stagnated into inertia. For they were destined to meet and merge with the Adamic race which was already incarnating into human bodies, though infinitely superior to those inhabited by the indigenous people of the earth. Already the Garden Beautiful was melting its environment onto the surface proper, perhaps because its pristine elegance had also been invaded by the perversion that was evident in the hardened crust below. It was becoming clear to me that there must be something very wonderful about man, for the Creator could so easily have destroyed this rebellious section of spiritual man and allowed the remainder to grow in his purpose and design unhindered by this defection. There must be something in man which even he could not destroy, because it was part of himself. And because he was love itself, he could only go on loving that which had sought relief in the illusory fastnesses of its own mentality. There could be no reality in the material life these people encountered, because it was so much less than good, so out of touch with divine creative beauty. So was born in me the conviction that man is a spiritual being in reality, the only part of him that really matters, that really is immortal, that never began and could never end. And the sense life he leads is so ineffectual because it has no real meaning beyond being a stepping stone to a life beyond his imagination. And as he rises to this understanding, so must his environment rise too, for it has fallen into materiality only to match his own fallen nature, held in that state only by the merciful will of a Creator who cannot fail and whose love will not let him go. I cannot resist a sigh of peace and happiness at this revelation of the purpose of the earth's destiny. How petty and transient all its material problems become when one views the prospect from this wide perspective. How infinite the love of the Father, while the measureless descent of the fallen race can be made the yardstick of the extent to which man, and his environment, can and must rise. Above all, the terrible thought of divine injustice which clogs the understanding of so many seekers after truth, was utterly annihilated. I began to see the Creator in a new light, one that was almost frightening in its immeasurable intensity. All this and much more Zeros explained to me, emphasizing the main features by actual visits to these primeval scenes. One vivid experience I call to mind. We were standing on a rocky headland looking out over a vast forest of strange, fern-like trees, immensely high. There is something rather peculiar and terrifying about primeval life. One is so close to raw nature and primitive instincts, and we found a very definite aroma of, what shall I call it, evil intelligence, in the atmosphere. It might have been the dark undergrowth with its hints of forbidden things, but I had an unmistakable feeling that in this seemingly peaceful scene evil lurked. I was sure of it. Zeros told me that it was because I was sensitive to the perverted creative forces which had to be employed to produce a living space in which perverted humanity might seek its release. Suddenly we were startled by a low vibrant murmur. It seemed to come from the air as if a great fleet of menacing bombers was approaching. We looked up expectantly as the sound increased. The harsh vibrations grew to a rhythmic roar, and a moment later, over the tops of the trees, came an enormous aerial reptile. I simply could not call it a bird. As it threshed its horrid weight towards us, I could see it was colossal in size. It had a scaly body which shone with a sickening sort of oily iridescence, its feet hung down terminating in huge talons, while its yawning beak displayed rows of vicious teeth. Clearly a carnivorous beast. The monstrous head yawed this way and that, as if seeking for prey. There was nothing of animal grace in any of its movements. For one ghastly moment it seemed as if our eyes met, its baleful gaze, cold and hateful, caught and held my fascinated stare. There was something utterly cruel and malignant behind those soulless eyes. It was evil incarnate, and the beast carried with it the stench of putrefaction. The thing passed above us and threshed its ponderous way onwards towards the horizon, uttering tremendous croaks that echoed over the forest. I turned and faced Zeros, horror in my eyes. His face held a look of infinite compassion as he answered my unspoken query. That creature was not deliberately created by God. But because of the wholesale perversion of the earthly environment by the sinful souls imprisoned in its astral surround, every attempt to create in terms of perfection was of necessity frustrated. The evil flocculants had to be got rid of through physical means, that was the only way. That is why the early animal life and vegetation was monstrous in size and a denial of the goodness of God. It had its purpose and fulfilled it, by passing much of this evil vibration through into the rectifying processes of the earth. As these animals lived and died, they deposited in the soil their excrement and in the end, their bodies. The very chemicals of the soil were planned by omniscient mind for just this purpose, that they might purify and reconstitute all the poisonous matter consigned to their operations. In this the tiny bacterial life played its part. Do you not see that even in your day when you putrefying matter to the soil, in the form of manure, in a short time it is rendered wholesome and fit to speed the growth of your food? Do not judge these animals, for they also serve their God. Chapter 8. Lemuria. Many attempts have been made to establish the locality and proofs of the existence of this fabled continent, said to have been situated in the Pacific, but with little impact on scientific beliefs and geological evidences. The fact is that Lemuria, more than any other part of the Earth's crust, had an existence more in the ethereal than in the physical. Zeros had tried to explain to me how the Garden Beautiful literally melted into a physical condition, a whole realm descending into material constituency. I am fully aware how difficult many must find this to accept, especially if they have any idea of geological formations and prehistoric events. We must just accept that unacceptability is evidence of how far we are from any real understanding of our true nature and that of the seemingly solid world in which we live. Our knowledge of the atomic theory has done much to explode our medieval notions of the nature of matter, but tradition and inhibited ideas die hard. In Lemuria we have to deal with an egg mixture of races, where the ascending race was making rapid progress along material lines, and the descent to their rescue of the Adamic race which was already coming under the dark spell of a people whose intellect was growing sufficiently to enable some memory of their past to invade their consciousness, bringing with it age-old desires for experiment, for conquest, for some expression of the great powers they once possessed. The task of the Adamic ones was to lift this consciousness as far above the mundane as possible so as to prevent the returning knowledge from being put to evil uses. This they did educationally and by the example they demonstrated to the inferior race. To these the Shining Ones from a spiritual world must have seemed as the saints do to us in our day. For not only were they beautiful by contrast, but they held their clairvoyant powers and their innate wisdom. Some of them became priest kings, holding great respect and great power over the darker peoples. Thus the embryonic minds grew towards intellectuality, and became subject to reason rather than instinct. It was from this land that the legend of the third eye emanated, and in primordial carvings of gods and goddesses this organ is often depicted, located in the center of the forehead. It was never biologically visible, being present only in the etheric body of an advanced soul. But the progress was not constant or always upward. The symbolism of sacrifice often degenerated into blood sacrifice. The initial idea was that of the liberation of the spirit from the flesh, but the value of the offering soon took greater place in the minds of the celebrants than the mystical meaning. There is a deep psychic significance in the shedding of blood, lost to our materialistic understanding, which released considerable psychic power in those far-off days. Adepts soon realized this and employed these powers to impress the worshippers, thus gaining much power over them. Till finally, through a terrible perversion of the law of love, they found that by sacrifice of their most treasured possession, the eldest son, immense effects were produced. I had many glimpses of this rapidly developing race, increasing in numbers due to the steady rise in the standard of living. It is not easy to recall what I saw of this people nor of the earlier races, because of the somewhat ethereal nature of matter as then manifested. The world was still not quite physical in relation to our rate of vibration, and so were the bodies of the people a little out of focus to my vision. It was because of the wholesale destruction of this continent by volcanic disturbance and subsidence that so little evidence remains of its erstwhile existence, though many feel that Easter Island holds the secret of its later culture. For the rest, we have to rely upon myth and legend and certain geological characteristics for any proofs of its locality. The giant Lemurians built great cities of lava like basalt, hewn by their great muscles into slabs beyond the capacity of modern brawn. Yet because it was then not so concrete as now, the effort would not be so great. In China and Mongolia there are relics of unbelievable antiquity thought to be associated with these peoples, while the Polynesians are thought to be their direct descendants. In those days everything was proportionately bigger than what we are accustomed to, and the great size of buildings, etc., and the giant forms of vegetation may have given rise to more modern notions that size means greatness. As the seasons changed, the Lemurians responded with appropriate ritual and ceremony, thus marking their growing acknowledgement of divine rhythmic processes of creation. Slowly they were becoming aware of a great power outside of themselves to which recognition must be given. Generation by generation enlightenment grew as the process of reincarnation enabled the sin-stained souls to seek rehabilitation in the remedial experience of earthly life. But as the intelligence of the incarnate souls grew, so did the dim memory of their one-time creative knowledge emerge into their consciousness. And some were not slow to put this knowledge to evil use once again. Zeros assured me that this had been foreseen, it could not be helped. The race had to be redeemed, even though some strove still to plunge it into fresh disaster. The indications were small at first, the self-confidence of a conqueror leading to overweening desire for power, the psychic powers of the priests giving them immense stranglehold over a superstitious people. Man had fallen through the misuse of his free will, and only through his free will could he be brought back to the fold. So the infection had to be allowed to spread, even though it meant ultimate disaster to this particular civilization. Spiritual beings in charge of this doomed race strove mightily to keep the evil within bounds, but these efforts were as flames to the fires of eager desire. Soon nation fought nation for mastery, tribe fought tribe within the nations. Perversion and black alchemy were practiced until the situation deteriorated beyond hope.